Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Jeanette Jalil, and as we record this edition at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 2nd of April, here are our main stories. President Trump says the US's stockpile of protective equipment and medical supplies for tackling the coronavirus is almost exhausted. Spain sees another record surge in COVID-19 deaths, close to 1,000 dead in just 24 hours. Also in this podcast, India's largest slum records its first coronavirus death, raising fears about the rapid spread of the disease there. And jazz pianist Ellis Marsalis has died at the age of 85 after contracting COVID-19. From hoax to horrific. President Trump's view of the coronavirus pandemic has shifted dramatically in the past couple of months.
Difficult days are ahead for our nation. We're going to have a couple of weeks starting pretty much now, but especially a few days from now, that are going to be horrific. But even in the most challenging of times, Americans do not despair. We do not give in to fear. We pull together, we persevere, and we overcome, and we win.
Mr. Trump has admitted that the U.S. government's emergency stockpile of protective equipment and other medical supplies is nearly exhausted. America has more than 200,000 cases, the most of any nation. Dr. Scott Samlan is an emergency room doctor at a Chicago hospital. He spoke to the American news network CBS. This is an excerpt from the interview during a few chaotic moments on his shift. He compared the conditions there to those of a war zone.
This is the most scared I've ever been being an ER doctor. And it's not just because of me. It's because I have a wife and a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old at home. I don't want to expose them. People say it's our job. It's not our job, it's our duty, and it's what we signed up for. I deal with gunshots every day and trauma and crazy stuff, and this is the only thing that scares me.
He went on to say that 60 to 70% of the patients seen at the hospital have the disease. The unprecedented demand for urgently needed supplies has led to the 50 US states competing against each other and the federal government, and it's led to profiteering. Our correspondent Peter Bowes told me more about the challenges Americans face in the days ahead.
The tone of the president has noticeably changed in the last few days as well. There have been more than 5,000 deaths here now, more than 200,000 cases, and those numbers are going up in leaps and bounds. And the issue over the last couple of days has been the availability of those vital supplies, medical equipment, ventilators and medical clothing, protective clothing, masks, that kind of thing. With the central supplies, those emergency stockpiled supplies that the country has in reserve for any kind of emergency, but it seems not an emergency on this scale affecting all 50 states. And the president acknowledging that those supplies are dwindling and dwindling fast. And this reflects a lot of the complaints and the concerns that we've been hearing about state officials, governors and health care staff as well. The president did say, though, that the stockpile was dwindling because he said, and he explained it like this, he said, look, this equipment is being made, it's being made fast by different manufacturers, and rather than being put back into the stockpile, it's being delivered directly to the hospitals.
So a change of tone from President Trump, but any change of policy, notably on a nationwide lockdown?
No change of policy there. That's something that he says he isn't going to do. He's going to leave it to the states. He suggests that it is the states' responsibility, individual states, to impose those kinds of stay-at-home orders, as they're described. And in practical terms, more than 80% of Americans are under that kind of order to stay at home. And some of those individual states adding additional restrictions over the last 24 hours, New York in particular.
Peter Bowes, as we heard, it's not only personal protective equipment, PPE, that's becoming a serious problem. Another big issue is the question of hospital equipment in general, especially ventilators. Billy Nongesa is the Lieutenant General of the U.S. state of Louisiana, one of the country's hotspots, which has been hit by a sharp surge in infection rates. He says it's a race against time to get vital supplies.
Well, we're seeing these numbers increase by over 1,000 people a day, increase with people that have the virus. And as you see, the death count keeps going up. But today, we have 490 people on ventilators. That's a great increase from yesterday. Now, we did receive 150 ventilators that the president had promised Louisiana in a conference call a few days ago. But that's far less than what we'd requested and far less than we need to make it through the next couple of weeks. At the rate we're going, we'll run out of hospital beds and equipment like ventilators in the next week. And people still are not heeding the warning in Louisiana to stay home. The gentleman that held church last Sunday had church again last night after being arrested.
Over the border in Canada, communities are also being forced to adjust to life under the threat of coronavirus. The BBC's Jessica Murphy has this report.
My Toronto neighborhood is right downtown in one of North America's largest cities. There should be people everywhere in bars and restaurants that line places like King Street. But like so many other cities around the world right now, schools and businesses are closed and everyone's been told to stay home. In some places, it can feel too crowded while people try to enjoy the early spring weather. The Toronto waterfront is still popular. Lake Ontario's expanse offers relief from cement sidewalks, skyscrapers, and right now, the indoors. There are dog runs and playgrounds along the route, but they've all been closed off with yellow caution tape. Some people have been using them anyway.
It is stupid. It is life-threatening.
Toronto Mayor John Tory was openly frustrated on news channel CP24 over the weekend at people who've been ignoring the rules.
How can we have a situation we had over the weekend where people are going to the areas we've signed and said, you must not be here, and it's an order that was put in place to keep them away from the playgrounds? We didn't do that because we were trying to sort of make families feel bad. We did it because that was a potential breeding ground for this virus to spread.
Toronto hasn't been hit nearly as hard by COVID-19 as places like New York City, but the numbers are always going up. Streetcars are usually packed with commuters and still rumble along the main streets, but now they're almost empty, a sign that life is very much on pause. On Queen Street West, in one of the city's most popular neighborhoods, one nightclub is no longer advertising upcoming shows on its marquee. They've been replaced by a sign that says, "Please take care of each other. See you all soon."
Jessica Murphy. Spain has been one of the nation's hardest hit by the virus. For the third day in a row, it suffered a record number of deaths. 950 people have died in the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of fatalities to more than 10,000. Only Italy has seen more coronavirus deaths. Guy Hedgeco reports.
With 950 deaths recorded, these have been the deadliest 24 hours so far for Spain since this crisis began. The number of new infections over the same period, just over 8,000, is also disheartening news. The government has been insisting that the spread of the virus is coming under control, but these figures will call into question how effective the national lockdown, now into its third week, is proving. Meanwhile, the economic impact of the virus is also becoming apparent. New figures released today showed that over 800,000 jobs were destroyed in March.
There's widespread disagreement worldwide about exactly which strategy will best contain the pandemic. China, and in particular the province of Wuhan, where it all began, managed to keep the number of deaths far below what we're now seeing in Italy and the United States. But how did they do it? Stephen McDonnell, our Beijing correspondent, reports.
The intersection where I'm standing was dead a few weeks ago. Now I look around. On one corner, the electric scooter delivery drivers are parked right next to one another. Diagonally across the road from them, in a small stall, the bamboo trays full of steamed pork buns are piling higher every day to meet the growing demand as more people return to work. China was facing a disaster not long ago. In Wuhan, soon after the outbreak started, footage of exhausted doctors sobbing went viral on social media as they pleaded with officials for more resources. Their patients were dying, as were some of their colleagues. Then, on the 18th of February, official figures recorded less than 2,000 new infections in one day. The next day was the same, and it kept going down. At that point, Wuhan had already been closed off from the outside world for more than a month. The Communist Party in China has options in dealing with this type of crisis, which other countries do not. Companies are ordered to close, they do. In Beijing, the managers of housing blocks are ordered to deny entry to everyone but residents. They comply. The technical surveillance capabilities of the Chinese state are overwhelming and can be simplified into easy-to-operate barcodes, which appear on everyone's mobile phones, giving a colour-coded indication of whether an individual is healthy, at risk, or potentially infected. The approach was broadly this: massively restrict all activity across the country, but completely lock down the emergency right at its heart, in Wuhan, throwing everything at fighting the disease from inside the belly of the beast. Military medics in their thousands flew in, as did armies of doctors and nurses from other provinces. Huge new quarantine facilities were built and indoor stadiums filled with recovery beds. In most of China outside Hubei, it was only a recommendation that everyone remained indoors, yet the streets of this country's vast cities went quiet almost overnight. There's considerable debate about the extent to which China's official figures can be trusted, but many analysts think that while the scale may have been played down, the trend in the figures seems broadly real.
Stephen McDonnell. Still to come in this podcast, why the powerful Orthodox Church in Georgia is refusing to change its ritual of using a shared spoon during Holy Communion despite the threat of coronavirus. A standoff between the Australian authorities and several cruise ships stranded off the coast has intensified, leaving thousands of people in limbo. The authorities have ordered the cruise liners to sail for home so that they don't flood local hospitals with coronavirus patients. But the crews of the vessels are ignoring the orders despite threats of heavy fines or even prison sentences. Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, told me why Australia was trying to prevent these ships from docking.
Here in New South Wales, for example, the police have ordered several of these cruise liners to leave immediately because there are fears that they could overwhelm public health services on the mainland in Western Australia. The state government there is threatening to take over a German cruise liner that's refusing to leave the port of Fremantle. This concerns the ship called the Etania, and it has been a cluster of COVID-19 cases. At least 40 people from the ship are in hospital. Hundreds of other passengers were flown home to Germany at the weekend, and the authorities do fear that there are more infections on board, so they want the ship to leave as soon as possible.
And some Australians are concerned about these ships because they fear that the already overstretched hospitals could be burdened even further if the people on board are allowed to disembark.
There are more than 5,000 known new coronavirus cases in Australia. 24 people have died. These figures increase every single day, and they are frightening many Australians. And clearly, they want their health services to be as best equipped as they possibly can to cope with what might be to come. They are deeply concerned, clearly, like many other people around the world, about this crisis. They are concerned, too, for those thousands of crew members of these cruise ships. And you have to remember that how would Australians react? What would they expect if they were a passenger or a crew member stranded on a cruise ship off the coast of Germany, for example? The cruise ship owners are calling for a humanitarian approach by Australia. But at the moment, as you say, we have this standoff between thousands of crew members on board several ships and the Australian authorities.
Phil Mercer. One of the largest slums in Asia has reported its first death from the coronavirus. Dharavi is home to more than a million people in India's financial capital, Mumbai. Tens of millions of people across India live in extremely overcrowded slums where social distancing is almost impossible. Our reporter in Delhi, Divya Arya, told me more about the person who died.
This was a 56-year-old man, and up until now he has reported no travel history, which fuels concerns about whether this points to community transmission in India. Now, he lived in this slum, Dharavi, in a building which houses 300 other families as well. He reported symptoms and was eventually tested positive just yesterday, but he died before the end of the day. Now, his family members, seven of them, have been put under self-isolation in the hospital where he was also taken to. The hospital has been sealed and the apartment where he lived has been sealed as well.
And given the incredibly cramped conditions in this slum, the huge numbers of people who live there, the big fear is that this disease could spread very rapidly and affect many people.
Indeed, Dharavi has really small alleys. You wouldn't even call them lanes between houses. There are open sewers, very cramped residential spaces. A classic house would not even be more than one room, housing maybe 7 to 8 people in one family. So the whole idea of isolating anyone who shows any symptoms is almost next to impossible. There's also concern about family members engaging with other families, even though India put a lockdown in place last week where everyone's advised to stay at home unless they're working for essential services. That's proven to be really hard to implement in places such as Dharavi.
And Divya, meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of migrants are trying to get home after the lockdown came into force. In Kerala, a group called Rights is trying to help feed some of them. Ajay Kumar is from the group, and he's warned that the exodus could spread the coronavirus.
A large number of sampling hasn't happened with people, so one doesn't know that whether the migrant labourers may have contracted infections or not. So one is being very cautious and careful in sending people back to their homes. And the other question also arises, even if most of the people reach home, will they have enough to eat?
And Divya, there's been fierce criticism of the lockdown in India, in particular for the way it's affected the poor.
Indeed, that enough arrangements weren't made and a lot of panic spread, which made these migrants move in tens of thousands back to their villages. They have been provided food and shelter and requested by the Prime Minister to stay where they are, but many feel the damage might already have been done.
Divya Arya. One of the unanswered questions in recent days is why some countries seem able to test far more people per week than others. Experts in Germany, for example, believe that one of the reasons the country has a relatively low death rate is because the authorities started widespread testing from early on in the outbreak, although the authorities have now warned it's rising and will continue to do so. Germany currently has the capacity to test up to 500,000 people a week. Evangelos Kotsopoulos belongs to the German Association of Accredited Laboratories and runs his own lab. He believes the strategy of widespread testing has definitely saved lives.
We think there are two effects when you look at the death rate or the case fatality rate, as it's called. One is a mathematical and a statistical problem. If you test a lot, you are also testing a lot of negative people, and statistically your death rate will be a lot lower compared with models where you test at the entrance to the cemetery. Your death rate will be very high. In case of Germany, very widespread broad testing has been done early, and that has had this statistical effect that the positive rates are currently at around 8 or 9% across the whole country. But it has, of course, also had an effect, which we think is much more important, that many actually positive cases were picked up very early. So people were asked very early, already a month ago, to remain isolated. Contact people were traced and tested repeatedly and were isolated as well. So the large and widespread testing has had this double effect of a statistically low death rate, but more importantly, of identifying very early who is infected and what should be done with these people before they infect others.
It's early stages, of course, still statistically, but is it fair to say that by testing so many people so quickly, the German authorities have already saved lives?
I think that is the case, and they have also managed to, as we say, flatten the curve a little bit and slow down the spread of the infection, at least relatively. It is still spreading, as we know, but it is still spreading every day, and the curve keeps increasing. But the spread would no doubt have been a lot more violent and a lot more pronounced or intense if this early testing had not happened. Plus, especially for patients who are at risk of complications because they have comorbidities, other diseases, elderly people, people who are immunosuppressed, for example, under chemotherapy, transplant patients, many of those who would really be at a personal risk of at least being admitted to hospital or worse could be picked up early through this testing. So yes, I believe the decision of government, regulators, but also health insurers here to test early and in a widespread manner was a very good decision. And it was, of course, supported by an industry structure which is equally widespread and was ready to ramp up this testing at a very early stage. So we will then shift to other types of testing as well to check for immunity in patients. And that's something which is certainly being ramped up and will be ramped up over the next few weeks and months.
When can we expect to see those immunity tests realistically ready and out in the community being used?
So the first tests are being evaluated as we speak. A number of developers, R&D groups, and also manufacturers have released the first tests, which we are using. Our laboratories are making materials from positively tested patients available to check these tests. We have been positively surprised how quickly also the IVD, the diagnostics industry makers, have come up with these new tests. So we are now optimistic that these tests can be rolled out in the next few weeks.
Evangelos Kotsopoulos talking to our Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill. Now to a story about religion and science and what happens when the two collide. In Georgia, the country's powerful Orthodox Church has repeatedly refused to change its ritual of using a shared spoon during Holy Communion, despite the threat of coronavirus. A state of emergency has been in place throughout Georgia for nearly 2 weeks, banning gatherings of more than 10 people. But as Rayhan Dimitri reports, those rules don't seem to apply to the church. Sunday service at Tbilisi's main cathedral. In this religious society, many have turned to God for help in uncertain times. Churchgoers are lining up to receive Holy Communion using a shared spoon to sip the wine, the blood of Christ. For several weeks, Georgian society has been debating whether the church should change its rituals during the pandemic and use disposable spoons. But many priests, including Nikolos Pachuashvili, say that faith protects their congregation from infection.
We know, რომელიც გარდაიქმნება სისხლად ვარძიმ შვიცითვე ზეარად.
Wine, which transforms into the blood of Christ in this cup from which we take communion, is an antiseptic. The spoon which is purified in this wine is also purified from bacteria.
That service was broadcast live on Georgian television. Nino Janashia, an independent human rights consultant, was watching it from home.
I was very shocked when I saw in the live TV, in almost every channels on Sunday, crowded churches. And after the ceremony, after this religious ritual, we saw thousands of people receiving this holy drink from the same spoon, including children, including very young children. And of course, the reaction in social media was overwhelming. Everyone was shocked because we knew from the beginning that it will spread the infection more and more, which is already spreading in the country.
Nino is one of more than 3,700 people who have signed an online petition requesting that the government force the church to follow the same rules as everybody else. That was the Georgian Prime Minister Georgi Gakharia announcing on March 21st a state of emergency that bans gatherings of more than 10 people. But within 24 hours across the country, people of all ages attended religious services in their churches. Some were asked to keep 1 meter apart from each other. The same religious gatherings continued this past weekend. The church says it is being criticized unfairly and at a time of crisis is providing a much needed spiritual relief to the nation.
This month, dozens of priests took to the streets in pickup trucks, scattering holy water, which they said helped to fight the virus.
Rehan Dimitri reporting there. In East Asia, many people do. In other parts of the world, people didn't, but are starting to more and more. I'm talking, of course, about routinely wearing face masks. Despite official guidance that they don't help suppress the spread of the coronavirus, questions refuse to go away. For instance, why are they considered to be of benefit to health workers, but not to the public? Now, as more countries demand their citizens wear them, the World Health Organization is considering whether to change its guidance on them. Jonathan Savage reports.
Caught on camera, the Czech foreign minister had nowhere to hide. There he was, Jan Hamáček, in a meeting with half a dozen others, not wearing a face mask. In doing so, he was breaking a new law and, owning up to his error on Twitter, announced a donation of 10,000 krona, about $400, to a hospital. The same amount of money Czech people are fined if they appear in public without a mask. Face masks are also compulsory in Slovakia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. As of Wednesday, you could add Israel to that list as well. But go to the US or UK and they're still an uncommon sight. Among the advice given here is that putting a mask on or off means you're more likely to get infected by touching your face with unclean hands, that the types easiest to come by are not particularly effective, or that staying 2 metres apart from others is a simpler precaution. But with evidence emerging that the virus can travel farther from a cough or sneeze than previously thought, the World Health Organization is considering whether to advise that masks really are an effective weapon. Here's advisor Professor David Heyman.
It might be that wearing a mask is equally as effective or more effective than distancing, provided that mask is worn properly, and provided that people don't infect themselves when they're taking the mask off and touch an outer surface which may be contaminated.
For the Japanese, wearing a mask over your nose or mouth when unwell in public was culturally entrenched even before COVID-19 emerged. But that hasn't stopped Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's new plan from being mocked. Every household in Japan is to receive 2 reusable cloth face masks, something critics have called both a waste of money and numerically inappropriate for households with more than 2 residents.
Jonathan Savage. Sadly, in recent days, we've had to announce the deaths of accomplished musicians who've succumbed to the coronavirus. The 85-year-old American jazz pianist Ellis Marsalis is the latest. He featured on dozens of records in a career that spanned decades. I asked our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd just how influential he'd been.
Well, you know, sometimes influence in art can be hard to assess, but not with Ellis Marsalis. He set out to influence, not just by being a fantastic jazz piano player, which we've just heard, but by being a capital E educator. He was born in 1934 in New Orleans, well, where else? But he was never into that old school New Orleans jazz. His style was more or less derivative of bebop. After leaving New Orleans at one point in his life, where his family ran a motel, he returned to start a serious career teaching and lecturing about jazz. And of course, he started a family.
As you say, he started a family which then turned out to be a musical dynasty.
Oh, and what a dynasty. He had super talented jazz musician sons, of whom only the 2 best known are Wynton, the trumpeter, world famous, and his slightly older brother, Branford, who plays sax. Branford has released a statement, "My dad was a giant of a musician and teacher, but an even greater father. He poured everything he had into making us the best of what we could be." And Wynton briefly tweeted of his father after the death, "He went out the way he lived, embracing reality." The family had helped keep jazz in the mainstream of American culture when the music companies were really starting to lose interest in the 1980s. CD sales were dipping and whatever. And Ellis, who'd always recorded, became much more in demand in the recording studio because his sons had such success. But he always taught. For a dozen years, he ran the jazz studies department at the University of New Orleans. And the Marsalises became really, it's a cliche, but it's true, America's royal family of jazz. When you read about Ellis this, it's clear he always expected the very highest standards of musicianship and involvement, social involvement, from all his students, including the likes of Harry Connick Jr., for instance. And that, of course, included his sons. Music and family were absolutely everything to Ellis Marsalis. Well into his 80s, he was playing jazz virtually every week at a club in New Orleans until actually only December last year. So at the age of 85, it's terribly sad he's gone, but an absolutely fantastic career.
Vincent Dowd. And let's end this global podcast with father and son Bramford together playing Sweet Lorraine.